Next case is 0578 and 05457, Ricky Lee Schaefer versus Westfield Insurance Company.
Morning, Mr. Chief.
Let's wait until your call then, please. Ms. Thomas.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, counsel. I'm Amy Thomas on behalf of Appellant Argonaut Great Central Insurance Company. Appellant Argonaut asked this court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals because the Court of Appeals erred in refusing to apply Gliadis. There are actually several bases upon which this court could reverse the Court of Appeals. Although they're related, there are some distinctions. The first one relates to the timing of this court's declination of jurisdiction in the first Argonaut discretionary appeal to this court. As the court is likely aware, this case has somewhat of a detailed procedural history, but for purposes of this appeal, there are only a few key dates. And for purposes of this first argument, really only two, which is the day when Argonaut filed its second appeal to this court, which the parties have referred to as Schaefer 2, and the date when this court declined jurisdiction. And as the court is again likely aware, that declination of jurisdiction occurred after Argonaut perfected its second appeal with the Fifth District. Argonaut submits that this court can resolve this case quite simply by explaining a rule relative to intervening decisions when cases are pending before this court for consideration of discretionary appeal. If the court issues an intervening decision that changes the law during the time when a case is pending before the court and the court has not passed upon jurisdiction, the intervening decision would apply to that case. And again, the basis for this, of course, is that the Court of Appeals' initial decision is not yet final. As a matter of constitutional law and as a matter of statutory law, that decision is not final. In this case, Argonaut asked the Court of Appeals to apply Gliadis before this court decided jurisdiction, declined jurisdiction, and thus made that initial Court of Appeals opinion final. We came into the Court of Appeals and said, please apply Gliadis. If you apply Gliadis, your previous decision is incorrect as a matter of law and should be reversed. The Court of Appeals did not render its decision until after this court declined jurisdiction and actually based its decision on kind of an amalgamation of vested rights and the peerless doctrine and res judicata. But it seems that both Argonaut and appellees disagree with the analysis of the Fifth District and have proceeded accordingly. The second basis for reversal of the Court of Appeals decision relates to the fact that the Court of Appeals remanded this case. The Court of Appeals affirmed in part, reversed in part, and remanded the matter to the trial court for further proceedings. Argonaut pursued discretionary appeal with this court. However, even prior to our filing that second appeal, the trial court, upon remand, filed a second judgment entry. And in fact, that occurred before, as I mentioned, before we filed our notice of discretionary appeal in Schaefer 1, and then, of course, before this court declined jurisdiction. This court issued Gliadis 19 days after that second judgment entry. It was at that point thereafter that we perfected our second appeal to take an appeal from that second judgment entry, which is really the only valid judgment in this case. So if there is a valid judgment, it comes from that second judgment entry. Again, the discretionary appeal was still pending before this court, so it was not yet final. We are in somewhat of a kind of a jurisdictional limbo, and it has proved difficult, but What we did is, as soon as Galatas came out, we had that second judgment entry, which was done at the behest of appellees, pursued our appeal and asked the Court of Appeals to apply it. Now, of course, because the trial court had entered its judgment entry prior to Galatas, we could not go into the trial court and ask the trial court to apply Galatas. Instead, we approached the Court of Appeals. But that, of course, is not fatal because the Court of Appeals shares jurisdiction with this court while a case is pending before this court for discretionary appeal. And the Court of Appeals actually can reconsider a prior decision during that time. That is all we were asking the Court of Appeals to do, is to correct a previous legal error.
Has our court addressed the intervening decision issue in Hopkins?
I'm sorry?
Has our court addressed the intervening decision issue in Hopkins versus Dyer?
Yes, I think it has. And
we need to expand on that, or how do you see that interplay with your argument?
Well, I think, going back to the first basis for argument, the case is still, of course, pending before this court. The Court of Appeals decision has not yet been finalized. It is still pending. On the basis of that first argument I presented, the declination of jurisdiction would be the end point. So the intervening decision would have to occur before this court passed on jurisdiction. So there's a finite timeline that we're talking
about.
But
isn't the fact, when an appeal is taken to this court, the Court of Appeals is divested of jurisdiction?
Once this court passes on jurisdiction. So, of course, in this
case, so the mere filing of the notice of appeal to this court, the jurisdictional case, that does not divest the Court of Appeals of jurisdiction?
No. This court has issued previous decisions indicating that the court shares jurisdiction concurrently, and, of course, the appellate courts have rules that indicate motions for reconsideration, although the court has indicated that in circumstances the court could sua sponte reconsider its decisions, but it's divested of
the court of appeals has rules for motions for reconsideration. Is that what you said?
Correct. So if they issue a decision that is unfavorable, they have set out particular timelines. So traditionally, you're going to have a set period of time, 15 days, to file a motion for reconsideration with the Court of Appeals. However, this court's prior case law suggests that in an exceptional circumstance, you could go to the Court of Appeals and say, reconsider this decision. The Supreme Court hasn't passed on it. You can correct this legal error. The third and final basis, again, is somewhat related to the second basis regarding the remand, and this relates to the res judicata issue. The Court of Appeals, as I mentioned, somewhat based its argument on res judicata. How I would contend that res judicata does not apply in this case, and that this is really a Hopkins versus Dyer case, that what we're talking about is the law of the case, that this court in Hopkins versus Dyer said that the law of the case must yield to an intervening decision such as Galatas, because this case is not governed by the principles of res judicata, but rather the law of the case. Hopkins versus Dyer can be easily applied to resolve this appeal. And if there are no further questions, I would like to reserve any remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Thomas. Mr. Schrock.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. This case is not about insurance. It's not about underinsured motorist coverage. It's not about Scott Ponser, and it's not about Glottis. What it is about is the finality of judgments, the limited scope of remand, and this court's continued commitment to the doctrine of res judicata. The fundamental issues that are raised by this appeal have already been decided by this court in three unanimous decisions: Fung versus Waste Management, State XREL NECA versus Ohio Bureau of Employment Services, and Transamerica Insurance Company versus Nolan. On the basis of that precedent and the restatement of judgments, this court clearly should affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals in this case. This case fundamentally involves two distinct claims that arise on two distinct insurance policies. Much of the confusion in this case arises from the fact that those two distinct policies were both issued by the appellant, Argonaut. I think the analysis of this case would be much simpler had those policies been issued by different insurers. If you had an umbrella policy carrier and a separate CGL policy carrier, it would be much clearer that when the Court of Appeals in Schaefer 1 affirmed the judgment that was entered in favor of the plaintiffs on the umbrella policy claim and reversed the judgment on the CGL policy claim, it would be quite clear that the only claim that's remanded at that point in time is the CGL policy claim. The umbrella policy carrier would not even be a proper party to the proceedings upon remand. This court then declined jurisdiction of the attempted appeal of the umbrella policy claim. At that point in time, that judgment became final. The Fung case that this court decided makes very clear that you can have a final judgment on one claim even though another claim within the same case remains pending below. That's an important principle which this court should definitely take this opportunity to approve and to follow. The last thing that this court wants to do is send a message to litigants that they should continue to appeal every last claim as long as they possibly can in the hopes that keeping that ball up in the air will somehow, at some point in time, allow them to go back and resurrect claims which have been finally disposed of. That's bad policy, and that's exactly what the appellant is actually trying to do here.
Would your argument be the same if, in this case, there was a dispute, there was only one insurance policy in play, but a dispute about prejudgment interest that was still alive, and the judgment itself was resolved in terms of final appeal?
I think that makes it for a different case, Your Honor, because you have an aspect of the claim which is not finally disposed of. Now, if in that same instance, for example, with a single insurance policy, you could potentially have a cause of action for a declaratory judgment and a separate cause of action for the damages portion of that.
And which is, we had a lot of those with respect to Gladys. That, I mean, as I recall, when all of those cases in the pipeline that were resolved as a result of Gladys, that was the argument, I think, in a lot of them as to whether or not it was over. Is the declaratory judgment part was over, but you still had the underlying case going forward.
And that's a distinction with this case. I'm addressing the question in the hypothetical that you posed, but it's much more clear in this case because you have the entirety of the case resolved and disposed of. And when this court declined jurisdiction in January of 2004 and again in March of 2004, at that point in time, all issues relating to the umbrella policy claim had been finally disposed of. There was absolutely nothing left to adjudicate on that claim. It was a final judgment for purposes of res judicata. What appellant is attempting to do in the course of this appeal is to come in through the back door. They're trying to keep the fact that the CGL policy claim was still alive and use that as an opportunity to come in and attack the final judgment on the umbrella policy claim. That simply doesn't work. As this court said in the state XREL NECA case, issues that are beyond the scope of a remand are not appropriate for review when that decision on remand comes up again. Anything relating to the umbrella policy was beyond the scope of the remand at the conclusion of the Court of Appeals decision in Schaefer 1. Therefore, under state XREL NECA, nothing about the umbrella policy claim is properly before the court in this Schaefer 2 set of appeals. This case should not exist.
Mr. Schreck, you are arguing finality of judgment and res judicata, while, if I understand Ms. Thomas, she's talking about the intervening decision of this court in Gladys. So are the two of you really talking past each other and not really joining an issue? Or are you discarding the intervening decision aspect and hanging on the doctrine of res judicata?
I think the answer to that question, Your Honor, goes to the question that you posed to Ms. Thomas about where does Hopkins fit into all of this. And I think that this court in Hopkins did answer the question about intervening decisions and the law of the case doctrine. But what this court did in Hopkins, first of all, was asked the question of whether or not there was a final judgment. And it found that in that case, because there were issues regarding coverage defenses that remained, there was never a final judgment. Hence, res judicata never came into play. I think that there's actually three distinct concepts here: res judicata, the law of the case doctrine, and the peerless electric doctrine about retrospective application. And those three doctrines create a three-part test. First, you have to answer the question, was there a final judgment? Because if there was, res judicata precludes any attack on that judgment, and at that point in time, the inquiry ends, and that's as it should be here. If there's not a final judgment, now you're within the law of the case doctrine. That's when you'd look into the intervening decision exception. That's no longer at issue here because of Hopkins. And if you don't get to that point, now you have to look at whether or not the intervening decision should be applied retrospectively under the peerless electric doctrine, and that's where you get into vested rights. As Ms. Thomas observed, the Court of Appeals decision in Schaefer 2 somewhat blends the concepts of res judicata and vested rights. They found that there were vested rights and termed their decision in that regard, but they found vested rights because there was a final judgment on the umbrella policy claim. You know, to the extent that this case requires an analysis of what exactly did the Court of Appeals do in Schaefer 1, the Court of Appeals itself answered that question. It said that it left the judgment on the umbrella policy claim intact. It did nothing to affect that. And I don't see how it could hold otherwise, because it affirmed all of the issues relating to that.
But was that a portion of the case that was then pending, or was it a separate case that was then pending?
I'm not sure I follow you, Your Honor.
Well, the umbrella case and the CGL case were tried. They were jointly presented, were they not?
They were within the same case number.
That's my point. So is this dividing a cause of action, or is this resolving a portion of a case?
No.
I guess that's – is there a factual issue with respect to finality between yourself and Ms. Thomas?
I don't believe so, because and this is where we get back to the Fung decision. The Fung decision clearly distinguishes that you can have a final judgment on one cause of action, even though another cause of action is reversed and remanded and remains pending. And when you have two distinct insurance policies, two distinct contract claims here, you have totally separate causes of action. I don't see how this court can reverse this case without overruling its unanimous decision in Fung. The cases are in lockstep with one another on that important principle.
Was the umbrella policy, though, secondary to the CGL policy? I mean, you're talking about excess coverage for the umbrella. Was it not in any way dependent on the CGL policy?
It was not. In fact, that was the primary issue in Schaefer 1 about the umbrella policy coverage, whether it was excess over merely Argonaut's CGL policy or also excess over other policies. And the Court of Appeals found that based upon the specific language of the umbrella, it was excess over multiple policies, which is yet another example of how these two claims are not at all tied to one another.
But it would kick in without any other policy to depend upon?
Without any other policy of appellant. There was another policy in this case that had been issued by Westfield Insurance Company, and the Court of Appeals found that Argonaut's umbrella was excess over the Westfield policy. And in fact, the parties stipulated to that.
Thank you.
What happened to the Westfield portion of the case?
It was settled.
Was that Scott Ponser claim also?
Yes.
So if all of your underlying Scott Ponser basis for coverage disappeared, then why do you have an umbrella policy remaining?
If the accident in this case occurred today, the answer to that question would be we do not. But we have a claim because that claim had been reduced to final judgment prior to anything impacting on it from the Gladys decision. I mean, that's why the court cannot fall.
Gladys decision took out the underpinnings of why you had umbrella coverage. So why wouldn't that affect the umbrella coverage? It couldn't. You don't have umbrella coverage if you don't have underlying coverage first.
That would be true, Your Honor. But again, the umbrella policy had been reduced to a final judgment. And when this court declined jurisdiction, that became final for purposes of res judicata.
But a final judgment based on having coverage from Scott Ponser under underlying policies. And didn't we address that? Didn't we address Fung in Hopkins? We specifically distinguished Fung?
You did, indeed. And that shows, I think, your decision in Hopkins specifically shows the fulcrum which divides Hopkins and Fung, and that is whether or not there is a final judgment. In order for this court to accept appellant's argument, you must find that there was never a final judgment in this case. And given that you have the umbrella policy being affirmed on appeal, and this court then declining jurisdiction of that appeal, I don't know how you can go there. Certainly, you're going to be overruling a number of your past decisions to do so.
Either that, or we can find that because the intervening case took out the basis that excess insurance was allowed at all, that it still would apply to the excess policy no matter what state it was in the process. I mean, you're having a judgment that's now hanging out there on its own with no underlying pinnings that give it validity, and you want to claim that that's a final decision when in fact that final decision hinges on there being underlying Scott Ponser coverage.
Your Honor, there were dozens if not hundreds of final judgments rendered that involved Scott Ponser claims, and I don't think that this court wants to open the Pandora's box of going back to all of those final judgments and revisiting them. I mean, that's, I think,
which is what Scott Ponser exactly did.
Well, and you know, I said at the outset of this that this case is not about Scott Ponser, and I truly believe that that's the trap of this case. The trap of this case is that this court, in its anxiousness to wipe out every last vestige of Scott Ponser, will make bad law in the course of doing so. And if you start to crack the mantle of final judgments and you start to call into question the doctrine of res judicata, you open up a can of worms that is far greater than anything that you want to do. I mean, this court has repeatedly said in numerous contexts that there is a definite need for finality, a need for certainty. In fact, in the concurring opinion in Gladys, that was discussed. And, you know, as I said, you don't want to motivate litigants to just continue appealing in the hopes that at some point in time, in the course of appealing their 10th claim, the law will change and they can go back and reopen claims 1 through 9 that were finally disposed of years earlier. We got a judgment in this case in August of 2002 on the umbrella policy claim. That judgment was affirmed on appeal. This court declined jurisdiction. Under all of the precedent of this court, that should end the matter. I think that when this court considers its precedent, when it considers its policy considerations, it has almost no choice but to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals. To do otherwise would be unwise and cause great problems. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Schock. Ms. Thomas, you saved 7 minutes of your time.
There actually was a final judgment in this case, and that occurred when the trial court entered its second judgment entry on remand from the Court of Appeals. This court need not overrule any of its prior decisions. There's a key difference between Fung and this case. In Fung, the claim that was dismissed was a dismissal of a wrongful discharge claim. So it was a defense verdict. It could go away, a judgment entry could be put on. In this case, even taking everything that Mr. Schrock said is true about the Court of Appeals adjudication relative to the umbrella coverage, Mr. Schrock could not take that Court of Appeals decision and do anything with it. He, in fact, understood that he needed to go to the trial court to have the trial court enter a final judgment because The Court of Appeals did not have any damages amount in its judgment entry. It simply said, we affirm in part, we reverse in part, and we remand for further proceedings. The trial court, another tribunal, had to act on that Court of Appeals decision for it to become final. The trial court did not act until it entered its second judgment entry. That occurred within the 30-day window of appeal, and Gladys came out, again, a very narrow window. So this fear that we're going to have lots of cases, lots of unwarranted appeals, I think we're talking about some very narrow windows of time here that ensure that litigants, plaintiffs, and defendants can avail themselves equally of intervening decisions that correct prior law.
Boy, the question is, was there a final judgment on the umbrella coverage?
For purposes of determining this appeal, this court can assume that there was a final judgment from the trial court. Now, the interesting thing, though, is the case was still pending before this court when the trial court entered that second judgment entry. So presumably, that judgment entry could have been nullified as well by this court's having accepted jurisdiction. And again, it's important to...
Well, let me ask you, our court had already undertaken jurisdiction at the time that the trial court entered the final judgment on the umbrella policy? It was pending here?
The time frame, Court of Appeals issues its decision very quickly. Appellees go to the trial court and say, enter judgment entry, because obviously they couldn't do anything with this piece of paper from the Court of Appeals. They do that within 2 weeks or so, well before the 45-day time period for filing a notice of discretionary appeal with this court ran. Argonaut, in fact, filed its notice of discretionary appeal. Gladys comes out before the appellees file their memo contra jurisdiction. Fast forward to January of the next year, and this court declines jurisdiction. And I think in part, it's also important to note that appellees in the jurisdictional memoranda before this court in Schaefer 1 said to this court, don't accept jurisdiction. This court doesn't need to do anything because it is pending before the Court of Appeals. And if Gladys applies at all, they said, the Court of Appeals should deal with it. So,
Counselor, was there a motion for reconsideration? You spoke to that earlier. A motion for reconsideration before the appellate court?
There was not. And again, Gladys did not come out until it would have been past the 15 days. And, you know, hindsight is 20/20. And I think had I had it to do over again, I would have asked the court to reconsider even
But isn't that the crux of your problem here? Without a motion for reconsideration, how does the appellate court, which you're saying, reconsider its opinion? Are you saying sua sponte? They were to take Gladys and say, remember that opinion we handed down a couple weeks ago? We better pull that back and change it, even though the trial court is already reversed and remanded.
And I think interesting procedural thing about this case that addresses that is that the trial court rushed to its judgment. So there is the final judgment from which we can appeal, because it was incorrect as a matter of law. And even though it did everything it was supposed to do by following the mandate of the Court of Appeals, it ultimately entered a judgment entry that was incorrect within the appellate time frame afforded by the
It wasn't incorrect when the trial court entered it.
That's correct. Absolutely.
But you're saying because you had a second opportunity to appeal this, you really didn't have an opportunity to appeal it unless Gladys came out.
Correct. Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, that goes to the exchange in the initial jurisdictional briefs that there was an understanding between appellant and appellees that the case was still pending in the Fifth District.
Mm-hmm. What did that August 2002 entry say? That's the one that the opposing counsel is saying was the final appealable order. What did that particular entry say?
It had both conclusions of law relative to the Argonaut CGL policy and the Argonaut umbrella policy. It found UM coverage in favor of appellees under both policies, and because we had stipulated to damages, it entered a damages judgment award as well.
All right. Thank you.
Again, in conclusion, this court can frame a very narrow rule that will address these situations. I think equity and fairness require such a rule, and we will not see the parade of horribles that appellees are suggesting here. We're talking about a very narrow rule that can ensure that all litigants can avail themselves of intervening decisions that this court has issued to correct the law, which is exactly the case we have here. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thomas. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.